Hello and welcome to the Human Rights Weekend here in Amsterdam. This is an event that takes place every year where, through film and discussion, we look at a variety of human rights issues around the world. In this audio discussion, we're going to talk with three experts about people with albinism, the challenges they face, the human rights issues involved, and some of the discrimination they confront every day. We'll also be looking at what governments are doing about it, or in many cases not doing about it, and how the international community and you as an individual can help. To start us off, we'll go to Lisa Luchtenberg, who is from the albinism section of the Eye Association here in the Netherlands, to talk about what albinism actually is.
Well, albinism is a genetic disorder. It's a stable disorder, and it's a disorder around pigmentation, which results in, most of the time, a very pale skin and white hair. But some people have brown hair. And also most people with albinism have a visual impairment. And in the Netherlands, where a lot of people have a pale skin, the skin of people with albinism is not that rare, and that's why the visual impairment is a bigger issue here in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. But in Africa, where most people have a darker skin, you can really see it when someone is different, has a different appearance. So over there, it's more a point of discrimination, mm-hmm. because people have a lack of education, what it is and how people or parents with sure. dark skin can have a white child.
Okay, well, let's move to Africa then. And also with me here is Grace Rubabula from Tanzania, who works on albinism in Tanzania, which, as Lisa said, is it's the same issue. It's the same from the medical perspective, but obviously from the social perspective, it's completely different.
In Tanzania, the concept of albinism is not very common and very clear to all people. Most of people, they lack knowledge on albinism. And of course, it is an issue which, like in most of the school, it is not taught. We don't learn about albinism at school level. So it becomes an issue because many people, they lack the knowledge on understanding why can one get a child with albinism. And because of that lack of knowledge, now people tend to discriminate. How can one with the black pigmentation bear a child who is white, a child with albinism? Now it starts from the family because of the lack of knowledge, and which have led to discrimination among the community, where people with albinism are looked down. And what we are trying to do as an organization is to create awareness among the community to understand why albinism, but also to understand the causes of albinism and the roles and responsibility of community members within the country, so that people with albinism cannot be discriminated, can be taken.
What kind of discriminate? When you say they're discriminated against and they face these uphill struggles, what kinds of discrimination do they face? What are some examples, maybe?
You see, sometimes people feel like if you have a child with albinism, it can be a bad luck. It's a bad luck.
Oh, I see.
And then it's like people will not like to associate much with the people with albinism because of that. And of course, because of low knowledge, they feel that maybe it is something which can be like transmitted from one person to another, even if you don't relate. So we really need to educate people to understand. And of course, we all know that people with the albinism, they are facing challenges, especially with their skin. They need to get protective gears which can assist them to get away from the sun rays. Mm, right. But the community members, if they are they are not aware of that, so people with albinism will continue with that challenge. So the way people they are those are the ways how people with albinism are being discriminated. Mm. Yeah.
Just let's go move on to the other person in the room here with me, Jonathan Pedno, who is my colleague at Human Rights Watch. And Jonathan, you've worked in Tanzania as well, and particularly seeing the effects of albinism has with children with albinism in particular. Can you maybe describe some of your research and what you've been doing?
We were in Tanzania and Mozambique, in fact, looking at the situation of children with albinism and how, you know, the types of challenges that they face growing up with albinism in East Africa. And it's really interesting because in East Africa you have a much higher prevalence of albinism than almost anywhere else in the world. You know, in Europe, North America, you have about one person in each 17,000, 20,000 that has albinism, whereas in Africa, you have one in every 5,000 to 15,000 births. So it's a much higher number of people with albinism in those countries. And they face, you know, I would say that they face three categories of challenges. The first one, of course, is the health, you know, challenges associated to their condition. It's the sun rays, it's a higher chance of having skin cancer if you're not able to protect yourself from sun rays. The second set of challenge comes from the community. It's parents, as Grace described, who are unsafe about, you know, insecure about having a child with albinism. Why, you know, my skin is black, my partner's skin is black, and then the baby is white. How is that possible? You have a lot of fathers, unfortunately, who would abandon their partner and the children because they think at times that the mother cheated on them. You have mothers who are ashamed, or family members in the mother's family who are ashamed, who will try and hide the children away. For a long time, there were children who were born with albinism and killed immediately. And then there is a set of beliefs in Tanzania, in Kenya, in Mozambique, in East Africa, in Africa in general, I would say, whereby people believe that people with albinism hold special powers, that they are a ghost, that they cannot be killed, that their skin or their body parts can be useful for, you know, to accumulate wealth or to obtain a political position or to solve, you know, any kind of illness. So there have been people in Tanzania and in Mozambique, Malawi, who have been hunting people with albinism, and especially children with albinism, because they are so vulnerable. So there's been a lot of killings of people with albinism, and that's obviously part of the challenge. The third challenge is the state's response. And in Tanzania, the government has been responding to this crisis, these killings of people with albinism. But the way in which they responded to it also carried a number of additional challenges. Children were separated from their families, brought to these temporary holding shelters, which are basically camps surrounded by fences.
So what was the justification for taking them away from their families? Like security and just saying, oh, we can protect them here in this gated camp or something?
Precisely. Sort of typical dilemma between security and freedom, on the other hand. So we've been taking away the freedom of these children to be with their families, to be with their community members, in order to protect them from people who meant them harm. But in so doing, of course, that created additional conditions and challenges for these children, separated at a very young age from your family, your friends. So those are things that we were looking at.
How much effort is the Tanzanian government spending? How much effort are they putting into holding accountable those who are actually, you know, committing violence? Because, you know, the way to protect them, of course, is education, as Grace mentioned, but also, you know, some kind of, you know, criminal process that actually finds those guilty, and, you know, if people are sure they're going to get caught and prosecuted, that's important too.
I'd say that in Tanzania, it's been an uphill battle, but things are getting better, I think. Back in 10 years ago, you had, rather significant numbers of people with albinism were killed. Perpetrators got away scot-free. There was no process to either go at the root of the problem, which is all of these beliefs in these beliefs in the magic of the body of people with albinism. But now the government has ramped up its response. They have criminalized, of course, such types of killings. Mm-hmm.
Is it a special type of crime? I mean, killing a child is a crime regardless. Right?
So, absolutely.
But have they made some additional?
They have. Uh-huh. There have been prohibitions now on what you call traditional healers or traditional doctors, which were seen by some people as being the ones who were communicating these rumors or these false beliefs. Mm-hmm. So those people have been forbidden from doing so. People who continued to do so were prosecuted. One of the things is that, again, you know, these beliefs are quite old, and these traditions have been there for a long time. People with albinism were likely disappeared, you know, children with albinism were likely disappeared before sensitization came, before organizations started to do outreach to the communities. But it was very much kept at the family level or the community level, meaning that if a child with albinism disappeared or was killed, it was not necessarily seen as a crime by the community, so people would not necessarily report it to the authorities. This is changing, and that's very good. People in Tanzania are becoming more and more aware. There's still, you know, a lot of work to be done, but there has been a lot of improvement. That's not the case in neighboring countries. So Mozambique, Malawi, Burundi, mm-hmm. the challenges remain very, very much present there. Killings
are continuing.
So in that
way, Tanzania is a few steps ahead and maybe kind of a model for the direction the other countries have to go?
I think several people would say so. But yet again, the response of the Tanzanian government has been slightly imperfect. So we're still hoping... Yeah, it's mixed. So we're still hoping to see the government of Tanzania take measures to both protect but also ensure that, you know, the rights of the children to be with their families are also protected.
Okay. So perhaps each of you could briefly tell me a story of a person with albinism that's affected you and really has brought home the human rights aspect of this issue in the story. Grace?
Through monitoring visiting, going down to the community, visiting family, I met with the family where a child was 10 years. According to Tanzania education system, a child is supposed to go to school at 7 years, but the child was just inside the house, not going to school, because the family thought he has albinism, he was not supposed to go to school. But again, when we talked to them, it was also associated with the fear. Who will take care when the child will be going to school or coming back from school? And from there, we advocated that by visiting the nearby school and talk to school teachers and, of course, family members. And there is that arrangement at the school where now the child is going to school accompanied by the fellow members, fellow students who are living nearby. They go together to school and then they come together. At least doing that, the child is now able to go to school. If that was one, who knows in other areas? Mm-hmm. So it's an issue that we really need to go down to the community members, where sometimes they don't get these messages, they don't get information, so that they can allow kids to go to school.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks. Lisa, if you can maybe highlight one person with albinism that you know, their story, and maybe how the rights issue has come to the fore with their particular story, or that particular story that affected you.
Well, human rights violations are not common here in the Netherlands on albinism, but discrimination still is. And I can give an example of that. Well, I have albinism myself, and when I was younger and it was summer, and I was just walking all over the streets or something like that, people were saying, do you ever come outside, or calling me white, or that kind of stuff. And also the visual impairment. At school, sometimes teachers don't want you to help me with providing the information in front of the classes. Mm. But in the end, here you can ask many people for their help. So in the end, it always works out well. But still, if you're growing up, it's harder that you look differently, or that you get socially excluded by other children sometimes. Mm-hmm. And there's one other short story I would like to tell.
Please.
When I was in Tanzania last year, mm-hmm. I met this girl, and she's so incredibly powerful. But her story is horrible. It's not only the fear that she lives in, but also she's raped many times, because also in some African countries they believe that if a man has HIV and they have sex with a woman with albinism, they cure. So this woman got raped many times, and it's just horrible to hear. And she's so strong and so powerful, and she's really...
I mean, just to be a target like that is just, it's really incomprehensible.
Mm. Yeah.
Jonathan, if we turn to you and your work. You met so many people with albinism and the families and communities. Is there one that particularly strikes you, in their story that speaks to you?
Yeah, there's definitely this this 16-year-old boy that I met in a hospital. There was a, you know, this organization was doing this medical screening, or this screening for skin cancer. So a lot of children and people with albinism came to that place. So we were allowed to join them and do a few interviews. And this 16-year-old boy, and he had several sores on his skin. Clearly, he had been exposed to the sun quite a bit more than he should have. And you know, his story was just really impacting, because his whole life until that point had been defined somehow by the fact that he had albinism, and his whole life was far from happy or perfect. When he was six, his parents died. That's obviously separate. But then he went to live with his grandfather, and even his grandfather was discriminating against him, calling him Chinese or Boli Buelu, which means white goat. And then when he was about 10, the killings started, and the school where he was going said, you cannot come to school now, it's too dangerous, you have to go to the temporary holding shelters, these shelters that the government created. So he was forbidden from attending school, but his grandfather wouldn't send him to the shelters nonetheless. So then he was forced to work in the field, caring for the cattle for his grandfather, who was drinking the money of the cows afterwards, and mistreating him. But thankfully, at some point, this young man who was living in this young boy who was living in a very isolated community, met with this man who did not have albinism but had a child with albinism. And when the man saw him, he said, how are you walking like this without a hat or any protective? You cannot be doing that. And the young man, Juma his name is, he didn't know any of that. He had never been told that if you have albinism, you need to protect yourself from the sun, or eventually find sunscreen, or All he knew is that albinism potentially equated death. That's all he knew about this condition. But thankfully, because of outreach efforts by organizations like KCBRP and others, he suddenly met with this completely random person who knew about albinism and directed him to the right resources. In fact, to the hospital where I met him. So that was quite impactful.
So that takes us to what we're doing here now in Amsterdam at Human Rights Weekend. What are the messages, if you had to kind of crystallize your message to what you want people to hear in your session today at Human Rights Weekend, what would that be in a couple sentences or two, Grace?
Yeah, what we want people to hear is all about protecting and promoting rights of people with albinism. They are people like other people. We should respect them. We should respect their rights. And this should not be done by like one organization. We need joint effort because, like you have heard, it started in Tanzania, but in Tanzania we have reduced it, and then it is going to other countries. So it is not an issue of one country. We should join effort to ensure that people, they really understand all about albinism and the causes of albinism. And then we should also protect the right from the family level to the higher level, even how like policies take that, ensure that they protect that light. That is what I can say. We really need to join hands.
Okay. Yeah. Jonathan, what would you add?
Well, I'd say, you know, there's this fantastic woman with albinism called Aike Iroh, and she's the special rapporteur for the UN on the rights of people with albinism. Mm-hmm. And for quite some time now, she's been doing these campaigns to try and ensure that at the sub-regional level in Eastern Africa, there is this joint strategy to protect the rights of people with albinism. And I think I think one of my key messages here in Amsterdam is certainly to call on people living in donor countries like the Netherlands, you know, Europe, North America, to really put pressure on their governments to support Aike Iroh's proposal. She's been going around in several countries. She's been engaging with the authorities, but still, you know, Tanzania has gotten the message. But I think there are still governments in the region that are not necessarily seeing that as a priority.
Right. And do you think donor countries are getting the message as well, or is it? I mean, do they see this as a priority?
I think there's a growing awareness of the problem, but I think the problem has really been associated with Tanzania somehow. Like it's you know, the stories of the killings, 10 years ago, it really emerged in Tanzania. I think the response in Tanzania has been, there is a response to begin with. So there are organizations that are doing this work, that are receiving international support. But as Grace was mentioning, the problem has been, spread across the region. It has decreased in Tanzania, and it has increased in Malawi, Mozambique, and other countries. I think it's important for donors not to see this as a specifically Tanzanian problem, but see it as a continental problem and really respond to it in other countries as well.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And Lisa, any last word?
Yes, I can also add something to that. It's also important that you think by yourself how you are maybe can change something about it. By starting your own knowledge about albinism and what it is, because if we look to Western films or series, people with albinism are always in these movies like they're the bad guys.
Yeah, I can think of a few. What was the Dan Brown?
Da Vinci Code.
Yeah, wasn't the bad guy in that someone with albinism?
Yes, yeah, okay. It was. Yes. So in that way.
It's awful if you think about it.
Yes, you're improving the stigmatization and the discrimination. So it's important that also the media, documentaries, are going to think differently about how they communicate about albinism and how we talk about albinism. And also we're talking about people with albinism instead of albinos. Because if you're saying albino, the person part is away. Right. And if you're saying a person with albinism, then it's clear for everyone that we're speaking about a person and not an object.
Talk about a person first, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, I think that's a very good place to wrap up. So if people want to know more about albinism worldwide, they can go to our website, hrw.org, and look up more, and we can put some links in the this video to other organizations as well to make sure that people can follow up. Thank you very much.